Days of Unleavened Bread are not over, but they're close to over. Maybe 4 hours from now, they are over. And looking at it, it's kind of a particular sequence of events that was unusual this year. Because yesterday was Good Friday. Now, what's good about it? I'm not sure, but it's been called, for all of my lifetime, Good Friday. Then we have the Holy Day of God, sandwiched in between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. So, tomorrow morning, Easter being Easter Sunday, you may want to arise early. We used to do that when I was a boy growing up on Christmas morning to go see what kind of presents we had under the tree. You may want to go out in your yard and nose around the bushes and see if you can find any Easter eggs. Check around under those bushes. If they are, and if you do find eggs, be sure they are hard-boiled and colored. So, we have about 4 more hours before this is over. I wanted to, as long as the Days of Unleavened Bread this year, I've been working myself, dedicating on truth, learning more truth, learning to be more sincere, asking, like the leper in the book of Luke, who came to Christ and asked to be made clean. Well, I've tried every day to repeat that prayer that the leper asked of Christ. You can make me clean if you will. And so that cleanliness and that purity is a part of what it means to have sincerity. Sincerity actually implies purity and cleanliness. And I talked about the water that we got in St. Thomas that was strained through a membrane which would only let small particles or small molecules through that screen. And so that's the kind of purity I think that we need to have, and we need to be looking to Christ to provide for us, because we won't do it ourselves. Well, today is a Sabbath, and it is a Sabbath also, in that it is a double Sabbath, isn't it? It is Saturday, therefore it is the weekly Sabbath. And it is also the holy day, the last day of unleavened bread. I was in contact with an individual in our office building. He has his own business now, running it out of our office building in Horseheads. And he asked me, I went over there to just pick up some mail. He asked me if we were keeping Easter. He knows that I'm involved in the church. I've discussed it with him before. He asked me if I was looking forward to and keeping Holy Week this week and about Easter. And so I told him, no, we don't keep Easter. We keep the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, and got into a little bit of explanation about the Days of Unleavened Bread, and he sort of cut me off. Surprise, surprise. But he's a good guy, and he's interested in these kinds of things. I thought about, in regard to this particular sermon, my baptism was when I was 12 years old, in the Methodist Church. It was a, not really what you could consider a real baptism. I was sprinkled on top of the head. The pastor came over and asked my parents if he could baptize myself and my sister because he needed to have some baptisms on Easter Sunday. So I was brought into the Methodist Church 1954 on Easter Sunday. To many people, Easter is the holiest day of the calendar. There's a real confusion about the whole matter, isn't there? Because there are two different branches of Christianity. I'll just interrupt here for a minute and say that this sermon is about a single point of truth. It's a very powerful point of truth and a very important point of truth, but it is about truth. And if we are ingesting sincerity and truth, putting truth into our lives, this is the point of truth we need to keep in the forefront of all of the things that we look at as years go by. I've entitled the sermon, One Sign. I could have said a single point of truth, but I didn't. I put down as the title, One Sign. What are the two branches of Christianity? The first branch, which is chronologically the first, and also first in terms of being correct, is primitive Christianity. We are considered to be primitive Christians. Now, to some, that's a pejorative. I wear it as a badge of honor because primitive Christians are those who believe in keeping the same customs that the early New Testament church kept at the time the Bible was written. If you believe in that and you do those things, it isn't just enough to believe, but you also need to do them. Asking, studying, obeying, if you do that, you would be considered a primitive Christian. For the first 100 years after the death of Christ, the church was a primitive Christian church. But after that, it began to transition, went through a sort of transitionary stage. These customs began to come into the church about the year 300. Constantine being a big part of it, his mother, Catherine, also being a big part of it. And the modern church was born. The primitive church, still we give evidence. Christ said that the gates of the grave would not prevail against the church. Your proof that he was correct 2,000 plus years later. The church is still in existence. But modern Christianity began to adopt a set of customs that have transformed Christianity from what it was to now being sun worship. They followed the customs of Nimrod and Baal and become, at least according to the, if you judge them according to the customs that they keep, they are, modern Christianity is not keeping the customs of the Bible, but rather has completely transformed Christianity. So let's look at, there's a great divide between those two. Primitive Christianity on one hand and modern Christianity on the other hand. Great divide between the two of those. Most people have never heard of the days of unleavened bread, even though they are Christians, even though it's written about considerably in the New Testament. they have not heard of, so much as heard of, much less understood, the days of unleavened bread. Now, they probably have some familiarity with the Passover, but almost no familiarity with the days of unleavened bread. Here's what Christ had to say. Matthew chapter 24, starting in verse 4 and continuing in verse 5. His disciples, Christ's disciples, had come to him and asked him that he would give them a sign about when would the time be that he was going to return. And of course, he didn't know. He explained to them he didn't know. Only the Father knew. Now, does he know today? I don't know. There's 2,000 years that have gone by since that time. Maybe he has, since that time, found out when it is that his return will be. But at the time he answered this question, he did not know. But he gave them signs anyway. Jesus answered and said unto them, the first sign that he gave to his disciples when they asked for a sign about when he would return. Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. Now, we were just informed a little bit about the fact that Satan is the great deceiver. If you want to read a little bit more about that, you can read in Revelation chapter 12, and you'll find there that the Apostle John says that Satan deceives the whole world. And so for somebody to say that we put too much of the responsibility for our own failings on Satan, that isn't squaring with what the Bible has to say. The Bible is saying that Satan is the instigator of it all, and when we come to the days, when we come to the Day of Atonement, we will find that he is really put under the responsibility for almost all of the sins on the face of the earth. So that's something that will come in September. Take heed that no man deceive you. Well, there's a lot of deception that goes on. Many shall come in my name. Christ is speaking now. You know, I could say to you that many are going to come in my name. Whose name would that be? Johnny Lambert. But Christ is the speaker here. He says, many are going to come in my name. Whose name is that? That name is Jesus Christ. That name is Christianity. Many are coming in his name. The great majority of modern Christianity comes to us in his name, but they are at best erroneous, which I think is the case with most of them, and they are deceived. But he says to us, don't let this deception happen to you. And we saw 25 years ago now, a great deception come upon a lot of the people who were in the church. But the gates of the grave have not prevailed against the church. Many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and they will deceive many. I have a bold statement here that I'm going to throw out. I say it's bold, but it is true. Easter is the great denial that Christ is our Messiah. Because most of Christianity has come in his name and said things that are not true and that are not according to the Word of God. So what I want to do in this sermon is to establish that Easter reflects false and deceptive Christianity, and the customs of Easter are actually a declaration This is shocking to most people, but the customs of Easter are a declaration that Christ is not the Savior of all mankind. Title of the sermon now was One Sign. So let's start looking at that sign as we conclude these days of unleavened bread. We're going to look at John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, and on down into verse 21 before we finish here. It's Passover time. Early in Christ's ministry, by the way, in the Gospel of John, from the, looking at the Gospel of John as the face of the eagle, there are seven miracles that are presented in the Gospel of John. Not that that's relevant to what I'm saying right now, but just came to my mind some of the truth that I noticed during the days of unleavened bread when I'm working on sincerity and truth. Well, this is Passover time early in his ministry. He goes into the temple and he turns over the tables where the money changers were. He makes a kind of a whip with leather thongs on it and drives out the money changers from the temple. They were making a profit by selling creatures to be sacrificed. Doves in particular it mentions here, but also lambs, goats, and oxen were being sold, bought and sold in the temple area for sacrificial purposes, but the real motivation behind it was a money-making scheme for these individuals. Christ went in there and he drove them out. This is not typical of the character of Christ, but in this one occasion, he was so angry, this is what he did. Chapter 2, verse 15. He had made a scourge of small cords. He, by the way, cancel culture is now saying we cannot have masculine and feminine pronouns in the Bible or in our religion. They're trying to eliminate that from our religious culture. He had made a scourge of small cords. He drove them out of the temple. And the sheep and the oxen poured out the changers' money and overthrew the temple, the tables. And he said to them that sold the doves, take these things out of here. Do not make my father's house a house of merchandise. Not typical of his personality or what he normally did at all, but in this particular occasion, he did that. They said, who does he think he is? Who do you think you are doing this to us? They were doubtlessly operating there under the sanction of the rulers of the temple. They couldn't have been in there unless they had been granted that permission by the rulers of the temple. And so as they were in there doing their money-changing operations, they had the sanction of the rulers of the temple. And they and these people and the temple rulers said, who do you think you are to come in here and do this? And they said, prove it. They said, prove it. You say this temple is your father's house. Show us a sign. Title of the sermon is One Sign. Show us a sign which will confirm that you are who you say you are. That's in verse 18. Verse 19, Jesus answered and said unto them, an answer that they couldn't comprehend, because as he often spoke parabolically, he spoke that way so that people wouldn't understand, so that he would give them the truth, but he would not be understood in the way that he was primarily meaning it. Jesus answered and said unto them, destroy this temple. Well, they're in the temple in Jerusalem, and he said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. They said, what's he talking about? This temple was 46 years in the building, and you will rear it up in 3 days. Someone was saying earlier about that they read, it was Alice, I think, had read about the magnificence of the temple. And I don't know that it was this temple that you were reading about or Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple was much more magnificent than this. This was like maybe the third temple that had been built. The others had been torn down. 46 years it took to build this temple. And you're going to tear it down and you're going to rebuild it in 3 days? You're nuts. But this he spoke of as the temple of his body. So what was he saying? What he was saying there is, you kill me, and in 3 days, I will be resurrected. That's what he was saying, translating the language. Later on, leaders in the synagogue, I think this was in Capernaum, but I might be wrong about that. Leaders in the synagogue, and it says parenthetically, scribes and Pharisees attempted to accuse Christ because he healed on the Sabbath day. Somebody may come to me or to any other minister on a Sabbath day and ask to be anointed, and we will do it. Here, they thought it was absolutely forbidden to be healing anyone on the Sabbath day. And Christ, of course, had the power to do it in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. So he had healed a man who had a withered hand on the Sabbath day in the temple. Verse 38 of Matthew 12. And he said that he had the authority. He said he was Lord of the Sabbath, and he could heal on the Sabbath day if he chose to. Now that those were fighting words. It says certain of verse 38 of Matthew 12. Certain of the scribes and the Pharisees answered, saying, Master. Did they really think he was a master? No. They were trying to accuse him. They were trying to trip him up. They were trying to find a way that they could bring charges against him and ultimately crucify him. Certain of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, Master, we want to see a sign from you. Now, what we read in the Gospel of John was apparently sometime earlier, And he had told the money changers at the temple that if they tear the temple down, he would rebuild it in 3 days, talking about his body. Well, here it is again. They ask him if he would show them a sign. He answered and said unto them, "Nope. Well, I guess maybe I'll show you one sign. One and only one sign." So the title of the sermon again was One Sign. And the point in one sign was this: one sign establishes that Christ is the Messiah, not only of his disciples, but ultimately of all of mankind. He answered and said unto them, he called them bad guys right here, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign." Now, I've heard people speak and say that asking for a sign is an evil and adulterous thing to do. That isn't what it's saying. Because just a few pages over in Matthew 24, his disciples came and asked him for a sign. And he said, "Okay, I'll give you a whole bunch of signs." He gave them two full chapters of signs about his return. So the mere asking for a sign does not establish that they were evil and adulterous generation. They were evil and adulterous generation here because they were trying to come up with, they were scheming against Christ and trying to come up with a way to put him to death. That's what they were trying to do. So they were evil and adulterous because of their motivation and the desire in their heart to see him destroyed. So he said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. There shall no sign be given." Well, wait a minute. There will be a sign given to it, but one and only one single sign will be given. There shall be no sign given to it except for the sign of the prophet Jonah. What was that sign? Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale. That's what it says in KJV, but I think in the original language it says the belly of the great fish. I don't know why that matters to us that much, but as Jonah was in that fish for 3 days and three nights, the Son of Man will also be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. That's the one and only sign that he gave that he is the Messiah. Now, his messiahship stands or falls with that sign. Was that sign fulfilled? If it was fulfilled, then he is our Messiah. But if it's not fulfilled and it fails, then he has put himself in a position where he's not going to be recognized as a Messiah. The messiahship of Christ stands or falls on the fulfillment of this one sign. So it's very important for us to look at this sign and determine whether or not he fulfilled it. Everything. stands on the fulfillment of this sign. On one hand stands primitive Christianity. On the other hand stands modern Christianity. Primitive Christianity believes in keeping the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. Modern Christianity believes in Good Friday and Easter Sunday. Easter eggs under the bushes in your front yard. Hard-boiled Easter eggs out there that you can go out and find in the morning when you get up. Of course, I'm being a little bit ludicrous there, but... Well, let's look a minute or two here at Good Friday. As I said, why would it be called Good Friday? But let's ask, was Christ crucified on Good Friday? First question, because modern Christianity says that he was crucified on Friday and put in the grave just before the weekly Sabbath. I was about the same time I was baptized into the Methodist Church, or sprinkled into the Methodist Church. Can't call it a baptism because baptism means immersion. But I was brought into the Methodist Church at that time. And my memory goes back to that time from time to time. I remember walking down the street in southwest Atlanta, not far from the high school where I was going to be going, and thinking about that. To me, it was kind of a conundrum that I thought about, ruminated on. Ruminating means to chew your cud. And I couldn't really come up with a good answer for it. But anyway, I came up with the question. Sometimes coming up with a question is as important as coming up with the answer. So I had this question. How could it be? It said, because I had heard that it was written 3 days and three nights in the grave, and I was a part of a group that was keeping Good Friday and Easter Sunday, and I couldn't square that with the account that he was actually in the grave 3 days and three nights. And I understood that it was the sign about whether or not he was the Messiah. So I just ruminated on it, put it away in the back of my mind, and didn't worry about it for some 10 more years. John chapter 19. Here's where modern Christianity comes up with the idea that Christ was put in the grave on Friday. John chapter 19, verses 40 through 42. They being Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, and maybe some of the other disciples, they are particularly mentioned though, took the body of Jesus off of the styros, the stake, is what it's called in the original language. It's not called a cross, it's called a styros or a stake. In some other places it is called a cross. So, whatever it was, they took his body down from there wound it in linen clothes with spices, as the manner of the Jews was to bury. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, there was a new sepulcher, or a tomb, or place for burial, wherein was never a man yet laid. There they laid Jesus, therefore, because of the Jews' preparation day. It was the preparation day. Now, modern Christianity thinks the preparation day only applies to the weekly Sabbath. And the preparation day is on Friday, the day before the Sabbath. And we are instructed in Exodus on the weekly Sabbath that we should prepare for keeping the Sabbath by doing the things that need to be done on Friday. It is the preparation day for the Sabbath. There they laid Jesus because of the Jews' preparation day. The next day was going to be a Sabbath day. And they put him there, it says, because the sepulcher was close by to where he was crucified. It was sundown. They were playing Beat the Clock, if you've ever seen that game show on television. You had certain things that had to be done, and you had to beat the clock in order to win the money. Well, here they had to get him in the grave before the Sabbath day started, because it was against the Jewish law to leave a dead man unburied on the Sabbath day. And so they were hurrying to put Christ in the grave before the Sabbath day. So, if they put him in the grave before the Sabbath day, modern Christianity presumes this must have been a Friday. And you'll find accounts of this in the other Gospels as well. And they just all indicate that he was put in the grave before the Sabbath day. This doesn't prove that Christ was being removed and put in the grave on Good Friday. Or doesn't it? I mean, from their point of view, it proves that he had to be being buried on Friday. He had to have been crucified on Friday. Therefore, Friday is Good Friday. And then Sunday morning, there's going to be the sunrise, and there's an Easter sunrise service. Doesn't Friday come before the Sabbath? Of course it does. But the sign. There is one sign that identifies that and proves that he is the Messiah of you and I, the church entirely, and of all mankind. That sign, he says, is the sign of Jonah. Of course, we can go back. It was also the sign that he gave when the money changers were in the temple. And he drove them out. He said, 3 days, and you can kill me, and I will be resurrected in 3 days. Same sign. But he said that as well to the Pharisees and the scribes in the temple, who accused him of Sabbath breaking because he healed on the Sabbath day. 3 days and three nights, he said, there shall be no sign given to this evil and adulterous generation except for the sign of Jonah. As Jonah was in the belly of the great fish 3 days and three nights, so shall the Son of Man be in the heart of the grave 3 days and three nights. How long is that? 3 days and three nights, a day and a night's 24 hours, isn't it? Three 24-hour periods. Mathematicians, can you give us an answer? How many hours would that be he was in the grave?
72 hours.
72 hours. We have mathematicians in our midst. That he was going to be in the grave 72 hours. Now he was put in the grave, if he was, according to the tradition of modern Christianity, put in the grave sundown Friday, would he be in the grave 72 hours by Sunday morning? Nope. That's maybe three 12-hour periods. 36 hours, about half enough time for the sign that was given in the sign of Jonah the whale. So it doesn't meet muster, does it? Doesn't meet muster. He wasn't going to be in the grave for that 72-hour period unless we've missed something somewhere along the way. That can't be the correct answer. So Good Friday to Sunday morning sunrise, sunset good on Good Friday to Sunday morning sunrise is not passing muster. It is a failure. We have this device that I kind of hate, but I have to admit it's a very effective tool. You don't go down the road and you make a wrong turn, and it's telling you how to get where you're supposed to be going. And this voice comes on the radio, says, recalculating. Recalculating, recalculating, recalculating. It's always a woman's voice. I guess men are too obnoxious. They're trying to avoid being, aggravating to the drivers. So they always have a woman who has a very nice sounding voice saying, recalculating, recalculating, recalculating. And then she proceeds to tell you what you need to do to get back on the track to where you were going. So that's what we're doing right now. We're recalculating because we find out that modern Christianity is entirely erroneous by saying that Good Friday to Sunday is a fulfillment of that sign, because it isn't. It can't be. Recalculating, recalculating, recalculating. How do we answer the riddle? John 19. This sign either fails. That's one of them. There are two conclusions we can come to here. This sign proves that Christ is not the Messiah because it fails. I mean, that's one conclusion that we could come to. It'd be an incorrect conclusion, but we could be incorrect, as all of modern Christianity has been. The other possibility is there's something here that we did not understand. And that's the answer to the situation. There is something here that we did not understand. So that's the second possibility. And the second possibility is the first in terms of correctness. John chapter 19 and verse 31. Still talking about the same event, the burial of Christ. The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation. Now you remember, modern Christianity thinks the preparation has to be on Friday, because they think the Sabbath, the only definition of the Sabbath in their mind is Saturday. The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath day. Parenthetically, John inserts this little bit here. In verse 31 of chapter 19, for that Sabbath day wasn't the weekly Sabbath. He says, for that Sabbath day was an high day. And what happens on a high day? Well, the first day of unleavened bread. What always comes right after the Passover, the first day of unleavened bread. Every time after the Passover, there is a Sabbath day the next day. We know that Christ was crucified on the Passover. And the day that they put him in was the grave, was a preparation for the high holy day, not the weekly Sabbath. Fact is, unlike what they understand, and I hope they will improve their understanding as time goes by, unlike their understanding, the fact is that every Sabbath day is not a Saturday. But every holy day is a Sabbath day. We know it. In fact, last Sunday, we were just over a little ways from where we are sitting in this room. But every Sunday, every holy day is a Sabbath day. Last Sunday was a Sabbath day. Because it was the first day of unleavened bread, a high holy day. And that means that for that week, the day before would have been a preparation day. John, face of the eagle, tells us that that Sabbath day was a high day. None of the other writers of the other three Gospels identify it as a high holy day. They just call it a Sabbath day. But it has to be, actually, the preparation day before the days of unleavened bread that year had to be Wednesday. And Christ would have been put into the grave at sundown on Wednesday. Now, till sundown on Thursday is one 24-hour period. Till sundown on Friday is two 24-hour periods. To sundown on Saturday is three 24-hour periods. How many hours is that? 72. We're going to find out here that Christ was resurrected at sundown on Saturday, because that's 3 days and three nights after he was put in the grave. And when he is resurrected on that schedule, it proves positively the one sign he gave. It is the one sign, very powerful sign. The one sign that he gave confirms that he is the Messiah. Modern Christianity, by keeping a Good Friday, Sunday morning resurrection, is in fact denying that he is the Messiah. If you look in Leviticus 23, and you will find that these Sabbath days, these high holy days, are called Sabbath days throughout Leviticus 23. It isn't only the Saturday Sabbath that is called the Sabbath, but you look in Leviticus 23 and you will see throughout there is a propensity to call the holy days Sabbath days. Well, here's the final nail to go in the coffin. John chapter 20, verse 1. This is when Christ had been resurrected. Now, nobody was there to see the resurrection. We don't know, except from the fact that he said he would be 3 days and three nights in the grave, that he would have been resurrected on Saturday night at sunset. But here in John chapter 20 and verse 1, Mary Magdalene came to the grave while it was the dark of night, before sometime, we don't know how many hours before sunrise, and he was already resurrected, allowing for the fact that he was resurrected, as the Bible indicates to us, that he was resurrected at sundown the night before. The first day, I don't know how it reads in your Bible, but in a number of the translations, you'll see the word day is added. I don't know why that's so relevant either. The first of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was yet dark. It wasn't sunrise. Apparently not even the sun was even starting to peak. To the sepulcher, and saw that stone was taken away. So we're recalculating. Early, while it was still dark. Does that allow for Christ to have been resurrected at sundown the night before? I don't see anything that prohibits that. It's just that when she got there, he was already resurrected. 72 hours in the grave requires that Christ would have been resurrected at sunset on Saturday. John chapter 20, verses 5 and 6. Mary went and told Peter and John, and Peter and John came running as hard as they could go, and John kind of gets maybe a little bit braggish here about the fact that he outran Peter and got there first. And when he got there, John verse 5 of John 20, stooped down, looked into the tomb, and saw the linen clothes lying, but he didn't go into the tomb himself. He wasn't that bold. Of course, Peter was the one who was the most bold. Then come Peter. Peter caught up finally after John had stopped, and he's standing there looking in, and he's seen evidence that Christ had been there and the clothing was left behind. And he came following John and went into the sepulcher and saw the clothes lying there. Christ was already resurrected and it was still dark. John chapter 20 and verse 15 and 16. Mary came again. I guess she didn't run like the boys did. And Christ appeared to her. He didn't appear to the others, but he appeared to her because she was so apparently so emotional about the fact of what had happened to him. Jesus said unto her, "Woman," I don't know. I don't know why he spoke to her, you know, in terms of that way. "Woman, why are you weeping? Who are you looking for? Whom seekest thou?" She supposed that Christ was the gardener. Said unto him, "Sir, here, if you have taken him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will take him from there." Jesus said unto her, "Mary," probably in a tone of voice that she would know who it was when he said "Mary" in that tone of voice. She turned herself and said unto him, "Rabboni," which is to say "Master." So there you have the people who testify to the fact that Christ had been resurrected. While it was still the dark of night, they discovered that he had been resurrected. And we can conclude from that he was resurrected at sundown 3 days and three nights after he was put into the grave on Wednesday. That is the one sign. It is a very powerful sign. It is a single point of truth, but a very, very important point of truth because of the fact that it does tell us that Jesus Christ is the Savior of all of mankind, as we sang. There is only one sign. There is one, but there is only one sign that Christ is the Messiah. 3 days and three nights in the grave. Recalculating. Let's back up. From sundown Saturday, 72 hours, and we find that Christ must have been put in the grave at sundown on the Passover day, which was the day which began the Holy Day, and he would have been put in the grave on Wednesday. The first day of unleavened bread in that year was on Thursday, the fifth day of the week. The traditions of modern Christianity utterly fail to identify Christ as the Messiah of all mankind. And it is an accusation virtually without them understanding or meaning it, because they don't understand that clinging to a sign that denies that Christ is that Savior. But primitive Christianity correctly identifies our Messiah and directs us in how we are to worship Him and to serve our Father. There is one and only one sign of truth. We are coming to the end of the days of unleavened bread when we were to understand sincerity and truth. That is one powerful point of truth.